Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
A very important milestone is being reached today on Research on Religion. We are celebrating our 200th episode. Yay! Normally, I would expect the staff to hold a big party with cake and everything, but since I'm the only member of the staff, and since I'm pretty lazy, I didn't plan any of that. However, there was some leftover Mother's Day brownies downstairs, and I was able to scrape that together. So I bought myself a party favor to make this seem all the more celebratory as well. If any of you dear listeners would like to celebrate the 200th episode along with me, here's what you can do. This coming Thursday, I will be at the sports bar down the road, and I will welcome anybody who wants to come and buy me a beverage of my choice. Alternatively, you could send an email, Facebook notice, tweet, or other means of communication to somebody that you know who might enjoy the program. Get them to be a regular listener. We are on iTunes at no cost other than going there and signing up. What better way to celebrate 200 episodes than to give the gift of free knowledge to the world? Yes, yes? Yay! All right. With that said, my guest today is an old friend of the program, someone we haven't talked to in quite a while. That is Bradley Wright. He is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Connecticut, where he specializes in religion, social psychology, and crime. I mean to say that he studies crime, he doesn't commit it, as far as I know. Professor Wright is also the author of two great books, Christians Are Hate-Filled Hypocrites and Other Lies You've Been Told, and Upside, Surprising Good News About the State of Our World. Both of these books were featured in earlier podcasts with us and were so good that they merited their own segments on our rotating banner of great shows at the top of our website. He also maintains his own personal blog at www.brewwright.com. It sounds like a home brewery beer making site, but it stands for Bradley R. E. Wright. That's BREWRIGHT.com. And we'll link to that website as well as the books on our website. So make sure you visit all of that. Brad, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Well, thank you, Tony. It's a real pleasure to be on the show.
Long time since we've had our last visit, and I learned that you were in the middle of building a rock fence back a year or two ago. How is that thing coming along?
Oh, I finally finished it. I thought that having a pile of rocks in the middle of the yard was like a nice accent feature for the yard, but apparently my wife didn't think so, so I had to finish the project and get rid of the rest of the rocks.
Yeah, wives are like that. So anyway, so you got the stone fence finished. What else has you been up to since then?
Well, lots of different things. This week in particular, I thought I would try playing with poison ivy on a hot day and then wiping my face, not knowing that I had handled poison ivy. And so basically I looked like a Star Trek alien, you know, with the puffy faces and the ridges and stuff. I went to the gym today and I scared a child out of the pool.
Yay! That's a great way of getting the pool to yourself.
Yeah, really. But more substantially than that, I've been working a lot on a project that we'll talk about for this show called Soul Pulse, and I've had to learn about so many different things. It's been a real joy for me. Learning is one of my favorite things to do in life, and boy, this threw me in upside down into the deep end in terms of learning new areas.
So you're working on something called Soul Pulse. No way, because I happen to be doing something called Soul Pulse. It's not the same thing, is it?
By happy coincidence, it is.
Oh! And here you thought we were just going to talk about stone fences and poison ivy today, but we're instead going to talk about Soul Pulse. What is Soul Pulse?
Soul Pulse is an ongoing study that collects information from people using their smartphones about what they're experiencing at that moment in terms of spirituality, health, what they're doing, social interactions, we get really cool data from the person, and then the person gets kind of a real nice report about what their life was like for the 2 weeks that they participate in the study.
That is pretty cool. Now, I heard about this via your website and Facebook page, and when I first heard Soul Pulse, I thought you were starting a new 1970s dance show. That's not it at all, is it?
No, it's not that interesting. Although, I will say that one of the things I'm learning in all this is how important titles are. And so as an academic, I signed an oath to have all the titles of anything I write or do to be long and boring and accurate. So we actually turned to somebody who's really a wordsmith to come up with a title for the website because we needed something that's kind of catchy. You know, so Brad's ESM study of spirituality.com just didn't roll off the tongue like I'd hoped it would.
No, it doesn't. But Soul Pulse, that sounds great. It for me, Soul Train growing up in the 1970s, I think the whole logo should be one of those Charlie Angels things or one of those things you saw painted on minivans back in 1975.
So maybe a silhouette of the researchers,
yeah,
like in profile with their hands up like a gun. I like that.
Yeah, or with smartphones. Because you can't do guns, even though you state crime. But yeah,
that's even better.
Do you have a theme song for it?
Brick House.
Yeah, Brick House. That would be good. That would be totally Soul Pulse.
That's my smartphone ringtone, and that's probably the best theme I could think of.
Yeah, that would be a good one. Well, I have to say that Soul Pulse is what we are here to talk about because I am in the process of doing it. It's largely a two-week process. I'm through almost 2 weeks of it. I think I completed my 21st or 22nd survey this morning, and it's pretty neat. I'm going to link to it on our website, so anybody who is in our listening audience that wants to go out and do it should actually give it a try. It's pretty easy. It's fun. But let's find out more about this project. First off, where did the idea of this project come about?
Well, it's a great idea, and it wasn't from me. I have, for my first two books, I got to know a pastor out in California named John Ortberg. He's written a bunch of books that have sold really well. He's not only an pastor, he also has a PhD in psychology. And for one of his books, he looked at positive psychology and applied it to Christianity. And in doing so, he read about Csikszentmihalyi, and I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, the professor at Chicago, his work on flow. And in reading about that, he learned about experience sampling method, which is a way of sampling people while they're doing what they're doing in the middle of the day, and then having them fill out a brief survey about what they're doing. And as he read about this, he thought, you know, this would be really cool to do to spirituality. And so he and a friend of his said, yeah, let's do it. But then they realized that they needed somebody to run it as a research project and turn it into a research project. So he reached out to me and we met, and as soon as he told me the idea, I thought, wow, this is really, really smart. And it really is a great idea. I wish I could take more credit for it. So here's the credit I'll take. I recognized it as a good idea really fast.
Yeah, and you are the main administrator of this. We're going to talk about some of the people involved in the program. Actually, go ahead and tell us who's all involved in this program. There's about
quite a few people.
Yeah.
It takes a village things.
Mm-hmm.
We have John Ortberg and Rick Blackman, and they're the two people who initially conceived of it. And they and another guy named David Carrion, who's a psychiatrist out of Stanford, are sort of like the oversight board. And then I have a team of computer programmers, I think three or four, headed by Luke Knepper, who's at Stanford. And it's a fairly complex site in terms of the back-end coding. It's really complex, and it took about a year to write. And lo and behold, an undergrad at Stanford is just really, really good at computer science, and this is Luke, and he did the computer programming for it. So that generates the data, and then there's a team of six researchers who are going to start looking at the data. They include Roy Baumeister, Crystal Park, who are psychologists, Lynn Underwood, who is an epidemiologist, Chris Ellison, a sociologist down at Texas, San Antonio, Jeremy Pace in UConn Sociology, and myself.
Okay. And you mentioned before, in terms of the programming, there's a lot of back-end programming, complex stuff that goes on. The website itself is very simple. In fact, it's a beautiful website. It looks extremely professional, very easy to use. And I assume that's part of the back-end complexity, that you have to do a lot of things but still make it look pretty simple and easy to use up front.
It is. I've learned so much about computer programming. And I don't do any programming myself, but designing computer sites. The design work was done by a graphic artist who works for eBay. And so he volunteered to do this. And so he's so tied in, he knew the colors of the iOS 7 system before they came out. And so he coded in those colors, so to make it look familiar to people. It's kind of the iPhone colors.
Oh, okay. See, I'm a Windows, really, I'm a Windows phone user, but it still looks good on a Windows phone. I'm one of three Windows phones users around the country. But and it works on WinPhone, so that is a very good thing. You said that this guy volunteered to do that for you, but you know, I know scholars were not into volunteering to do work all that often, so you got to pay for some of this stuff, and I'm sure you had to pay for the programmer out there at Stanford. Did you get grant funding for this, or you hold a big car wash? What'd you do?
I tried to sell my rock walls, but no one wanted them.
You take too long to build them.
The work came from three sources. First of all, we had a lot of volunteer work done, mm-hmm. just because it's such a cool idea. There's a lot of people who said, yeah, I'll help you get this going. And then we got some private donations that were rather substantial. And then just this last fall, we got a pretty large grant from the Templeton Foundation.
Yay!
So they looked at the project and said, well, they seemed fairly interested in it, and a couple specific themes in it, and they gave us over $400,000 to run it for the next 3 years.
Very cool. And now, is this...
By happy coincidence, $400,000 is more than I need to put a jacuzzi in my office at work.
Yeah, well, you know, don't tell anybody else that that's what you're using the money for. Just tell them that they need to keep volunteering. So that all works out pretty good. Has this eaten up a lot of your academic time? Has this been an all-encompassing project, or is this just something that you do on the side maybe 2 or 3 hours a week?
Somewhere between,
okay.
But closer to the first. It's taken so much time. You know, so it took me weeks to figure out that graphics are important and work with different graphic artists or our graphic artist and another person about the look of it. Basically, I tried to be involved in every step of the way, every decision, just because sometimes the decisions would feedback on the quality of the research and the quality of the data collected. And I didn't know which would. And so I couldn't sort of outsource anything completely. I had to be involved in it, even though it's the other people taking spearheading a specific task with their expertise. So it took a lot of time. And that's part of why the Templeton grant was so validating, because by getting it, sort of like I had something to show for the time, mm-hmm. my department head and dean and so forth.
Yeah, they say, what are you wasting your time for getting people to fill out questions on a cell phone? That doesn't sound very academic. But actually, it kind of does, because recently there has been this move toward big data.
Mm-hmm.
And big data is all about mining the interwebs and all the other places you find social media and gathering information, compiling it, and trying to figure out people. I mean, the academics are doing this. The grocery store that scans your groceries is figuring out all this stuff. And it's the biggest thing to hire now in academics, at least in political science, I assume so, in sociology and economics. Is this part of the big data movement? Are you guys kind of like big data, something a little bit different? What's going on?
Oh, I would say we're cousins to big data. So as I understand big data, the numbers go to 11. I'm sorry, I couldn't resist.
There you go.
As I understand big data, it's making sense of data that are already being collected or that are already out there.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, Target spent a lot of time looking at their customer rewards program to figure out if they could predict when women were pregnant before they had the baby, or before they told anyone, even. And they were able to. This is similar to that in that we're using data from everyday life. It's a little different in that we're explicitly collecting the data, and the person knows that they're giving the data.
Mm-hmm. So
we're cousins.
Yes, cousins in terms of basically leveraging social media for a lot of this stuff, I would guess. The big data movement, people are mining Facebook pages to figure out, again, if you're pregnant or about to become pregnant or, you know, whatever, by the way you click things. But nonetheless, the technologies behind using social media are some of the things that you're taking advantage of here. And as I mentioned, I am part of this study. I signed on before I decided to interview you. I said, I'm going to give this thing a try for a couple weeks. It's a 2-week study. And I get a nice little text message every morning. Comes on my phone. I usually, you know, wake up and it says hi and don't forget to take your soul pulse survey today. And then I go on and it takes me about 2 to 3 minutes. And I think on the website you say about 3 to 5. Is that?
Yep. That's the average is about 2.5 minutes.
About 2.5 minutes. So I'm right there. I'm right in the ballpark. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty neat. Actually, it's a fun thing to do. Right. There's these little thing buttons you can push. And I love pushing buttons. And I am also one of these people who loves to take surveys. So when people call us up on the phone and my wife says, oh, it's another consumer survey. I said, wait, I rushed to the phone. I said, let me talk to them in person because I feel so lonely and I need to talk to these surveys. But I love doing it. So I love pushing buttons. It's kind of fun. And so let's go ahead and talk about this. You're recruiting people. We're going to talk about the different ways you get people involved, but the idea behind the study. What kind of basic information are you trying to collect from individuals? So if I went to Soul Pulse, or one of our listeners went to Soul Pulse, what would they be expected to be tapping on their cell phones to give you information about?
The data that we're looking for, Tony, come in two flavors. One, we collect data from people when they sign up from an intake survey. Those are questions we ask just once. You know, what's your gender? What's your age? Some questions about class, some questions about personality, health, just things that we don't think will change over time. So we can think of as traits, sort of stable characteristics of the person. And the other type of data that we collect are in the daily surveys. They happen twice a day for 14 days. And those are the 2.5-minute surveys you were referring to.
Mm-hmm.
And those were looking for things that we think will probably change, you know, if not moment to moment, at least within a day or across days. Things that we look at include spirituality. You know, what are your spiritually related emotions? What are your spiritually related thoughts or attitudes? We have a lot of questions about health. You know, do you have a headache right now? are you sick? We have some questions about interpersonal conflict. And then we have a lot of questions about what you're doing at this moment. Are you lying down? Are you standing up? Is it sunny outside? Are you with somebody? What are you doing? And that's where it gets at the power of this approach, is that instead of taking the person and putting them on the phone or taking the person and putting them in the lab, you're instead having them fill out information about what they're doing as they're doing it. It's sort of like it's pretty common to see students these days at universities just, you know, they'll be walking to class or in class, especially my class, and text or you know, check Facebook or something. Well, we're doing that as part of a study. It's like, what are you doing right now? And so there's a real nice, what sociologists call ecological validity or external validity. You know, you're kind of getting them in the situation.
Before we get into the in the situation questions, I want to talk a little bit about those intake questions. So anybody who goes there and does this is going to fill out a survey. That one takes maybe about 5, 6, 7 minutes, and it's filled with what I always call the usual suspects, right? You mentioned gender, age, education level. You start talking about a few health things. One of the things that surprised me was you asked me for my height and weight. Yeah, and that was a tough one to put in there for me because I'm kind of short and stocky, right? So you could probably find me pretty easy in the surveys. Look for the short, fat Irish guy or whatever. What were some of the thinking that went on behind the intake stuff? Was this just let's throw in a bunch of variables that we always use in sociological studies? Or is there a bigger vision behind the project of these are the things that we think are important for studying certain types of questions, and what might those certain questions be?
Well, that's a great question, and it took us a long time to get our head around what's the role of the intake questions. In a traditional sociological survey, you ask those questions at time one, and then you use them to predict what happens at time two. But this is kind of a different breed of cat. We're not going to use them as predictor variables, because all our predictor variables will be from the daily surveys. So instead, we tried to get at things that we thought would alter the things that we looked at in the day-to-day surveys. So in statistical terms, these would be moderating variables or interaction effects. So basically, what are things about people that might cause them to experience spirituality differently, or health differently, or social psychological things, characteristics differently. And so that's why we chose the intake survey and the questions for it. But it really took us a while to get out of this sort of the standard mindset of, okay, this is what you ask in the first survey, and then you use it to predict the second survey.
Mm. So what were so you did some of the let me back up here. Let me ask you, when you're sitting down doing this project and you're thinking about the intake questions, you're thinking about studying something. What is, mm-hmm. I mean, what are you thinking as, to find out if people grow in spirituality at certain points in time, mm-hmm. to basically just measure the spirituality of the American population? What are you looking for here?
Okay. So what we're looking for is to understand how spirituality and a number of related concepts work in day-to-day life. So how do people experience their spirituality? What is this effect? What affects it? One of the things we'll be looking at is spirituality and health. There's been lots of linkages between the two in past studies, but they've used sort of long-term studies where you measure spirituality 1 year and health the next year. But is the effect quick enough such that what you're feeling in a given moment in terms of your spirituality can affect your health in that moment? This is the kind of study that can answer that kind of question.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition, we're looking at to understand how patterns of spirituality and related concepts like love, joy, peace, self-control, how they unfold over the week, throughout the day and through the week. So do people, for example, have higher levels of self-control at the end of the day or at the start of the day?
Mm.
And so trying to sort of map out the day-to-day aspects of spirituality and link it to things that we think are interesting is what we're trying to do with the study.
So now digging into these daily surveys, and there's two of them, and they usually come sometime in the morning to maybe early afternoon, and there's usually one in the evening. We'll talk about how these things pop up at various points of time on your cell phone here in a second, but I want to talk about the questions since we're doing that. And I have noticed, and through the 21 or 22 that I have done already, I get some common questions. Almost every morning I'm getting questions. How many hours of sleep did you have? How well did you sleep? They ask me, who are you with at the moment and what are you doing? And then there's also, in terms of spirituality questions, I very commonly see, are you aware of or are you feeling close to God at the minute? Are you feeling joyful, loved, loving toward others, or grateful? So those seems to be some of the standard ones you're mm-hmm. looking at, correct?
Yep, absolutely.
Okay. Then there's some semi-regular ones that pop up. Not all the time. They're not every day. It's like might be every second or third day. I'll see questions on how many drinks have you had in the last 24 hours? Do you get into an argument with anybody in the last 24 hours? Did anybody disrespect you? There's a bunch of other ones that are in there as well that pop up semi-regularly. Was there an intent to not have those every single day, but just have those every
yep.
other day or something?
And there's also questions that we only ask once.
Ooh.
So the weather question, you'll get that once.
I don't think I've gotten the weather question yet.
Well, that's because you're in Washington and it seemed irrelevant.
Yeah, exactly. It's raining again, so.
Yeah, really. Yeah. From your zip code, we just have a little algorithm of, yeah, it's cloudy and rainy.
I have to ask this because you're working with a team. You got some psychologists here. You got some sociologists. You probably gathered around a table at some point in time or on a conference call. Is everybody throwing these questions into the pot of stew, or are, you know, where are you getting these things? And is there some argument over what should be included, and were there ones that were excluded?
Two great questions there. So one is about the frequency of the questions, and two is the source of the questions. Let me answer the first one first. For the frequency, this took us forever to figure out what we wanted. Because, you know, I've never had training in this. I think only a couple studies have been done like this using smartphones. And so we just kind of had to make it up as we went along. And there's a tension here because if you ask every question every time, you can only ask maybe 15 or 20 questions.
Mm-hmm.
And that really limits what you can study. Also, it's really boring for the respondent, and they're less likely to participate every time. At the other extreme, you can ask a different question every time. So, you know, 28 surveys times 20 questions, so, you know, close to 500 questions. And that'd be easy to do. But then you can't measure how people change across days. So we wanted a mixture of the two. And the more important the question was for us in terms of what we anticipated studying, the more often it's asked. So the things that are asked every time, like, how aware of God are you? Are you feeling grateful? Who are you with? The self-control questions, those are things that we anticipate using a fair amount.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a couple questions that we ask just about every time, the sleep question. We have another band of questions that we ask about a quarter of the time, a quarter or 33% of the time. And those are asked often enough so that you can do with in-person variation analyses of them. So you can look at what statisticians call multi-level modeling. And then we have a series of questions where you think, hey, this is a crazy idea. Let's throw this in there. So we have a question of, is it sunny outside right now? And, you know, who knows? Maybe that'll make a difference. Another one is, when was the last time you checked your Facebook page? You know, this isn't a study of Facebook pages, but with this cool idea that, you know, maybe being online has some effects on health and spirituality. So let's just take a quick glance. Now, as far as where the questions came from, I talked to each of the researchers who are on the research team and sounded them out for the things that they were interested in. And then I made sure that those questions, one or two, usually a scale of maybe five or six questions, were represented on the survey. And I chose the researchers in part because I thought they'd be interested in what was already on there. So it wasn't, you know, six people with six distinct research agendas who happened to come together. Everyone was fairly interested in the spirituality, health, social psychological aspects, except for Jeremy Pace. He's on there because he's our methods expert,
mm-hmm.
because the data are so complex. We needed a really smart methods person, and so that's why he's there.
And in terms of introducing new questions since you've began this, and actually, how long have you been doing this program? How long has it mm-hmm. been online?
It's been online since November 2013.
Okay, so about 6 months. 6 months. Have you decided to add in any new questions? Somebody say, oh, wait a minute, we forgot to do this. We should throw this question in.
Yep.
Or,
well, that's the nice thing about this type of research is that, you know, I could sit down and add a question right now. What do you think of Tony Gill's podcast? Excellent or fantastic?
Yeah.
You know, give him a choice.
Yeah.
And, you know, it could be up and literally it could be up and running within about 3 minutes.
Hmm.
And two of that would be my computer warming up.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So we can change. The problem is two things slow us down. One, we have to run it through IRB, any change we make to it.
Wait, what's IRB?
About that more later.
Okay, we'll talk about IRB later. Don't let me forget, because IRB sounds like a very menacing thing, and it might be.
And the second thing is that we want to collect enough data for every question that we can carry out our original intentions. And so if I'm constantly changing the questions, the data just get confusing to work with.
Yeah.
So right now, we've collected about 1,700 respondents so far. I'm thinking at around the 2,500 or 3,000 respondent mark, I'm going to reconvene the research team and ask, what do we want to tweak here? Are there some questions we want to ask more, some less? Are there some we want to drop? Are there some we want to add? And already there's a couple changes that I want to make. And so I'm just keeping a list in my Evernote file of changes I want to make. The big problem is we all want to add more. We don't want to get rid of anything.
Yeah.
But we can't make the daily surveys too long or people won't take them.
Yeah.
And so I have kind of a strict length neutral policy that for everything we add, we have to drop an equal amount. And that makes it really tough.
Yeah, no, I can see how a lot of different research agendas are going to collide with this. But on the other hand, this is an ongoing thing. And
mm-hmm.
you know, once the thing gets up and running, you could do 1 year of looking at this kind of stuff. And then in the
Absolutely.
Next year, change it around. One of the other things I should say, and I really like doing this, as I mentioned, I like taking surveys, but it's a really innovative way of doing things as compared to survey methodology in the past, in part of the way that you're doing some of the measurements. So we have these questions of how close do you feel to God right now? Do you feel loved by others? Do you feel loving toward others? And you have the scale thing. And usually on the phone, they say on a scale of 1 to 7 or on a scale of 1 to 10, you know, rate how you feel in regards to that. But this on, you can also take this on the computer, but also on your smartphone, you basically have this sliding scale, like a little thing that you can go back and forth on. And that's pretty neat because, you know, I look at this and I say, okay, how close am I feeling to God? And I'll put my finger on one part and say, I don't know, maybe I'll slide it back a little bit. And I'll notice if I pause on it a little bit, the number might appear. It might say 53 instead of 50. Because one of the problems in survey research is you ask 1 to 10 people, 5, 6, what does that mean? But these sliding scales seem to be a better measurement tool for really gauging what people are feeling, or at least more fine-grained feelings than your typical survey. Was that a benefit of the thing? Or
yeah, well, you put your not the hammer on the nail. You put your
I put my finger on the sliding scale.
There we go.
Yes.
It took us a long time to figure out how we wanted to do this. Originally, we started off with 10 dots. You just poke the dot that you want. But we realized we're losing a lot of information there.
Mm-hmm.
And our programmer and our graphic artist came up with this slider. And it probably took a month. I mean, it's really complicated.
Hmm.
But it looks just so simple. You swipe left or right.
Yeah.
And that number appearing when you pause, that's kudos to the programmer. That was his idea, and I think it's just a nice, sweet idea. The the advantage of it is that it speeds up the survey because you can swipe faster than you can type in a number. And also, it sort of fits with how you think of using smartphones. You usually think of smartphones as, you know, point and shoot with your finger rather than typing in text. And let me tell you about one of the many issues that arose in our beta testing. So we launched in November, but we had it up and running, or some version of it, for about the 6 months prior with beta testers. And these are, you know, friends, family, coworkers who would take it just to see if the doggone thing worked. And initially what we did, Tony, is we had that bar with a circle in the middle, and we said slide it left or right. Well, it turns out about every 10th time somebody would just leave it there, say, yeah, that's about right.
Mm.
And what was happening is that we were invoking the anchoring and adjustment bias,
mm-hmm.
where they would see the dot, and that would sort of draw their evaluation to the middle. And so we thought, oh, this isn't going to work, because we're basically telling people what to choose. We're pulling them toward the middle visually. So the programmer figured out a way that you have to touch the bar, and as soon as you touch it, wherever you touch it, the round thing, the circle, pops up, and then you can slide it left or right. And so it's kind of some complex programming, but and we didn't figure that out until about user 200. And so when we do histograms of some of the variables, there's always a little spike right at 50,
yeah.
because it took us a while to figure that out. But that's the kind of thing where I didn't learn that in grad school. You know, we had to just basically learn it from trial and error.
One of the other things, too, that's interesting methodologically, and I used to do survey research many, many years ago in a private firm, and also did a little bit with in my academic career, is that once you ask a question and you say, on a scale of 1 to 10, how do you feel today? And somebody says 7, you move to the next question. It's hard to go back and re-answer that. And one of the things that I've noticed as I've used this is that it would ask me a question such as, how are you feeling close to God today? And I'll put in a number on this little sliding scale, and then I'll go to the next question, which is, you know, do you want to feel more in touch with God today? And I'll put something down, but then I'll go back and reevaluate the previous question and say, you know what, maybe I haven't been feeling as much in touch with God today, and it's really that I want to feel more in touch. And so I will go back and readjust some of my answers on a comparative basis. Is that an advantage of doing it this way, or might that be causing some other kind of methodological bias?
I'm a little more worried about the latter.
Really?
Because you don't want question two, you don't want question order to change the question to any one question. So I don't want I want you just to answer question number one by itself and not be influenced by question number two, or more commonly, I don't want your answer to question one affect question two. Because of that, we set it up so that how the questions are asked are in a somewhat random order.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't always get this question following that question. Sometimes that question follows this question. And sometimes they don't appear together at all. They're not in the same survey.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to mix it up precisely to avoid that word, the question ordering effect. But we still may be invoking it.
Yeah, and that's an interesting issue, because I know that there's, when you do a survey, you don't want to signal in advance what the survey is actually about. You usually start with very vague general questions, open-ended questions, and then you filter down to more narrow questions. But I don't get the sense that that's happening here. In fact, I look at it more as an advantage that, you know, okay, am I feeling close to God? And then you look at the next question, maybe I'm not quite, and you readjust it. And I could look at three different things. It'll ask me my mood. Are you feeling grateful? Are you feeling joyful? And I will sit and think of those three things and say, oh, okay, grateful, joyful, thankful. You know, I'll put, you know, all those in different orders. And actually, I think it's a benefit. I don't know.
Okay.
You'll have to see how this comes out, because it's a new methodology. I'm not used to it. The other thing I have to rave about the program as well, and this is going to move us into the issue of sampling here and getting people to actually fill out the surveys, is that when I receive one of these messages in the morning on my text, on my phone text, it pops up, you got a text from SoPulse, and I look at it, every time it comes up, there's a little different message there. And it's a cute little personality. It's almost like there's a little elf in the phone saying, hey, it's time to wake up and take another SoPulse survey, or hey, don't forget what time it is. And it's actually kind of neat that it prompts me to do these things. I actually look forward to the text. I mean, was that part of the philosophy or the strategy behind this too?
Absolutely. And this is what makes it so interesting, is that it's not just sociology. It's not just the state of religion. We got into its human-computer interaction, which is apparently some subset of computer science.
Hmm.
And my computer guy, Luke Knepper, studies that, and he pointed out that the more personal we could make this, the more people would respond.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, by having that, you know, cute little elf in the phone, we get better data. Because I started off with sort of just the dragnet approach, just the facts. Here's your survey. Thank you. But he's like, no, we got to put a voice. So that little elf, and by the way, I'm going to have fun teasing him about that. That's Luke's voice. He can do friendly,
yeah,
on a computer site really well. And so I said, okay. And so we ended up running basically most instructions through him, and a lot of the prompts, I said, just do the prompts as you see fit. And because he does have a nice voice for it. And that gets into a larger issue of people tend to treat their phones or computer programs as people.
Mm-hmm.
And so we respond to them almost as people. So if you're on a website and it gives you a smiley face for something you've done, that makes you feel good, and it makes you do more.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why websites and apps pay a lot of attention to rewarding you psychologically to get you to use them. And that's kind of what we're trying to do here.
And it's working on me. I will tell you that.
Okay.
I enjoy it. I like I said, I've taken almost all the surveys, although I logged on today and I found out that I missed three surveys. I think that was one from this morning, and I hadn't quite gotten around to taking it yet, which actually brings up another issue, right? These texts come up at certain points of time, so one will pop up at 9:30. But I'll be driving my car then, and I'm not taking it. How do you deal with that issue? Because you're talking about a contextual survey. What are, mm-hmm, you doing at the moment? It's assuming that it's 9:30, but I might, well, I got to get to work, and then once I get to work, get to my office, and now it's 10:20.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you deal with that issue?
That's a big issue with this type of research. What we did, and we based this off of what we saw with another study called Track Your Happiness out of Harvard. So we borrowed a lot of their methodology, and I think they're the ones who pioneered this, Matthew Killingsworth up there. So to give credit where credit's due, is that we say that if it's not safe, or if you're unable to take a survey, just remember what's going on in that moment,
mm-hmm,
and then take it as soon as you can. The median time for taking a survey is 20 minutes. So half the daily surveys that are taken within 20 minutes, half longer. And maybe like 30% are taken with 10 minutes, 15-18% are taken within a minute.
Mm-hmm.
So if we wanted to, we could analyze those data separately and see if they give us a different story.
Mm.
But let me tell you a funny story about somebody already doing something else where they couldn't take the survey. As you know, here at UConn, there's a state law in the charter for UConn that we have to win a national basketball championship at least every other year or every third year.
Yeah, so, and you do pretty well at that. Yeah,
just, you know, to clear the decks the next couple of years. And as part of winning a national championship, I'm told, you get to meet the president.
Mm.
So, in fact, last year, one of the women's basketball players, when they posed for a picture with the president, held up bunny ears behind his head. So there she is giving bunny ears for the official photograph to the leader of the free world, which is kind of fun, I thought.
Yeah.
Anyway, one of our beta testers is on staff with one of the basketball teams. And so he was literally in line to shake President Barack Obama's hand when he got a text from Soul Pulse. He waited until he was done shaking the hands. I don't know how the Secret Service would have felt about him pulling electronics out of his pocket.
You know, you could have gotten so much publicity if that person pulled out their smartphone, held it up to the photo, and, you know, had Soul Pulse sitting there and like, oh my gosh, you know, do Soul Pulse and meet the president or something like that. That would have.
I like it.
Yeah. So, yeah, there are moments like that that I get the text or I'm one of these old fashioned people that I don't have my cell phone in my hand all the time. It's laying around the house and I usually lose it. So, you know, I've been one of these people that, you know, 2 hours later, and I do have to think back, oh, how was it at 10:30 today? How was I feeling? And mm-hmm. so that was a little bit difficult. But again, you can collect that data that here's when the text was sent and here's when they took it. And that's kind of interesting in and of itself. How are you finding people to do this? Now, you mentioned you had some beta testers. Those were friends and family. Sounds like you're grabbing some UConn undergraduates that might be in sociology. But how are you doing this, as we call in, you know, statistical methodology, how are you performing the sampling?
Well, that's actually the tough part for this methodology. I think it does a great job at measurement. Sampling's more challenging. And what we want is a diversity of people to take it. And so in a perfect world, I could randomly select every 100,000th person in the country and have them take it. The problem is it's self-selection. So people sign up for it because they're interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
So we get people who are interested in this kind of topic, which means that they're different than people who are not interested in this kind of topic. So already there's a problem. Also, it has to do with spirituality. And a lot of the questions are traditional survey questions, but they really resonate with a sort of a Christian worldview. And so we have some qualifiers up front saying, you know, if you don't believe in God, you know, think about what's holy to you or what's, you know, of great truth or whatever. But that is an issue. So the way we've recruited is we've tried a handful of different approaches and to see what works. We got lucky early on in that the Associated Press ran a story on us, and that drove maybe 1,000 people to the study and from all over the country. So that was a big plus. We're looking into using Google AdWords, marketing through social media, you know, Facebook and Twitter. And also, we're looking to start publishing reports about our findings, and then bloggers who are constantly looking for content, hopefully, will start posting our findings on their sites, which will feed people to it. Ultimately, what we have to offer is understanding about one's life. So at the end of 2 weeks, you get this nice report that illustrates how your spirituality, how spiritual emotions such as love, joy, and peace vary over the previous 14 days and how they vary by gratitude, sleep, drink, exercise, all sorts of cool findings, and that drives people. But that does cause problems for sampling.
Yeah, I can imagine. Do you have any concern about what I could loosely call hackers, not necessarily the people that actually hack into the code of the program and change things, but people who say, hey, you know, this is about Christianity in the United States, and I want to teach those Christians that they're all a bunch of goofy people, and they log on and they give false answers or try to skew the survey in some way or another.
Well, actually, going into that question, I was worried about the first type of hacker, somebody breaking into the site. So we've put a lot of work into the security of the site. In terms of, you know, being able to hack it, as it were. Mm-hmm. In terms of people giving false answers, I would hope that doesn't happen, but there's really no way I could know if it is. In terms of Christian versus not Christian, one of the questions we ask up front in the intake survey is, you know, do you have a religious tradition that you adhere to or not? And if not, you know, do you believe in God or not? And that way, atheists can identify themselves. And we're interested in how atheists experience spirituality. And so that way, there might be a bit of a, you know, cut your nose off to spite your face element to giving wrong answers to promote your group. But if people do give wrong answers, I'd like to ask them to do it randomly. It doesn't bias their findings, it just creates a little bit of noise.
Yeah, do you have any information now about who is taking this? I mean, you said you got about 1,800 mm-hmm. folks who are doing this. Is it the younger crowd? Are they millennials because they love their cell phones? Are you getting some older people? Is it mostly Christian? Are there any Jewish folks? Who's participating?
Boy, great question. Those are that's the first question we asked once we started getting the data in. And what we find is that we're trending older rather than younger, and that's a surprise.
Mm.
So we have more 40, 50, and 60-year-olds than we do 20 and 30-year-olds. And as an ad hoc explanation, I think it's because the AP story drove so many people to our site, and I think older people read newspapers in a way that younger people don't.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be my guess as to why. We're skewing a little bit female. So in other words, we have more like 55% women, 45% men. And I think maybe women are more interested in spirituality and religion than men are.
That's pretty close, though, in terms of, you know, you look at other surveys that are conducted, too. Women tend to be a little bit more open to doing the survey. So, yeah, you're in the ballpark there.
In terms of religion, 80% of our respondents so far identify with some Christian tradition.
Mm-hmm.
About 15%, or 10 or 15%, 10 to 12%, I'm sorry, 10 to 12% identify themselves as having no religion. And so we're a bit underrepresented there, but we have some variation. And then we have a smattering of other religions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And those are the main things we've looked at. But as we're moving forward, we're going to create weights, sampling weights, that try to get at how representative somebody is of that type of person in the United States. And so we'll count, and our analyses will count the male answers a little more than the female in terms of generating population estimates, simply because we have more women than men.
Yeah, the surveys always tend to do that according to who answers the survey, so there's always a different weighting algorithm. One of the questions I have, and this is a problem with larger surveys like the National Election Study or the General Social Survey, which are very long surveys, is people tend to fall off. There's attrition bias that occurs. Have you noticed any attrition in these surveys? And again, you have to do this for 2 weeks, and it's twice a day, and it's variable. You have an algorithm that says, you know, kind of randomly drops these things in your text box every so often. Are people following through all the way? Is there, you know, 90% of them will do the first 3 days and then quit, or vice versa? What's going on there?
Great question, and this is something that we've really worked hard at minimizing. Because if people don't give data in a systematic fashion, it changes your findings.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out we've actually had more problems with the intake survey than the daily survey.
Mm.
And what happens is that people hear about it, they say, oh, hey, this sounds cool, I'm going to sign up. And then they realize they have to do something for 5 or 8 minutes. And it's like, well, I don't have time now for the intake survey. And then they just don't get back to it. So we've actually had more problems with the intake survey than the dailies. The dailies, they get answered about 70, 75% of the time, and it starts off at about 80% for the first time or two or three or four, and then it sort of plateaus at about in the high 60s for the rest of the survey. And we thought it would start dropping off a lot. Now, that's part of why we made it a two-week study. Our initial version of it was 1 month, and we got feedback from beta testers that was just too long.
Yeah.
They lost interest. But the 2 weeks, hopefully, and this seems to be borne out in our response rates, is short enough that people will just sort of power right through it.
And that is true. I would tell you this as a user, if it was a one-month survey, 1 month, oh, that's a long time. But 2 weeks, it you get a report at the end. So I'm kind of curious, and so I want to plod through the 2 weeks. I shouldn't say plod through, but you know, move through the two weeks and see what happens at the other end. And that's enough time to wait for me. That's not a month. So that's pretty good. I have noticed, and I did this today when I logged onto the site, that I had missed 3 surveys. I think I mentioned that before. One of them I knew about because I was at a bar. Maybe I was at a bar. I shouldn't tell you this information. But
you don't remember?
I do. Well, yeah, no, I do remember. I was just kind of saying that you might go in and find out, you know, who's this guy at the bar kind of thing. But somebody called me away to do something, and I'm like, okay. And I came back to do the survey, and it was timed out. and I wasn't able to go back in and do it. I assume that's one of the missed surveys, because I know I didn't fill out many of the questions, maybe just one or two before somebody engaged me in a conversation. And the website gave me the opportunity to reschedule these things.
The rescheduling is there for people who say they have to, during the 2 weeks, they just can't do it for several days. And they want to add the several days to the end.
Okay.
But again, that raises a problem in terms of representativeness.
Mm-hmm.
Because presumably, you're doing something different when you're too busy to take the study than when you are not too busy to take it. And what we want is, as much as possible, a random sample of all situations and all times. And this gets away from that. And it's just, you know, it's a shortcoming, or it's a potential, it's something to be minimized as much as possible. Now, we're still miles ahead of just bringing them into our office and having them fill out a survey.
Right.
But it's not ideal.
There's that other issue, too, about when people are more likely to take a survey. If you're in a bad mood and you get a text saying, hey, it's time to take a survey now, and it has a smiley face, I'm like, get lost, you know, I'm going to show you, right? But that's kind of the data that you actually want to catch. You want to catch people in a bad mood and how they're feeling about their relationship with God and being joyful and all those kind of things. Have you noticed any potential biases in that regard?
You know, we haven't done the analysis yet, but we will. And what we're going to do is, since we don't know, if somebody doesn't take it, we don't know if it's because they're in a bad mood. But we can see if people take longer to respond when they're in a bad mood. And then we can assume that things that make people wait longer to respond are also things that make them not take it. That's a leap of faith there. But I don't think it's too uncommon in survey research to do that. And so part of what we're doing is we're trying to figure out the method, its strengths and weaknesses, as well as create cool data.
And I have one more question before we get to some of the results, or at least the top-line results, what you're seeing with that cool data. And that deals with the administration of this stuff. We mentioned the IRB, which stands for the Internal Review Board. And all colleges and universities have these. For anybody who does research, you have to go through a process of inspection of your research project to make sure that you're not jeopardizing the safety or compromising the situation of any individual. How has that process been for you? Because, you know, this is a something that comes into your cell phone. You're asking them about relationships with God, and boy, that could be sensitive information, and you're mm-hmm. at a secular university, and how did that process go for you?
And this is a methodology that only two IRBs or two or three IRBs in the country have ever seen, so they don't know what to make of it.
Yeah.
We're actually lucky here at UConn in that we have an IRB who's very patient and very willing to engage new things in a thoughtful manner. So they've been exceedingly helpful. From colleagues at other universities, I've heard horror stories of IRBs that just stomp down on good innovative research. So we've been very lucky here. But even then, this type of research is very dynamic. It works best when you're changing it almost day to day. But the IRB wants you to go through a several-week process to make any changes. And so there's a tension there where we have to sort of do our changes in batch. So we'll wait for a month or two or three and then figure out what changes we want to make, and then we do them all at once. And then we get approval, then we do them all at once. So that's the biggest tension I've had, is just basically getting approval in a timely manner, which they're good at getting things turned around, but it would work even better if I could make approval, changes, day to day. It just, that's not the way it works. And so there's sort of a balance there between the needs of the IRB and the needs of the method.
Yeah, and you have to get IRB approval for every question change to begin with, right?
Yeah.
It's not just, I just changed the wording a little bit, but now they get pretty tense about changing of wording and got to mm-hmm. see all that stuff. What about confidentiality? Have you been able to maintain confidentiality here? You're not going to take all my answers and put them all throughout your Facebook page or anything like that? Because it will be easy if you look at that 1,700 data points. I bet it's pretty easy to find Tony Gill in there.
You know what? We have 1,700 people. They've generated 600,000 individual pieces of data.
Mm.
Now, if I had a lot of time, I might be able to figure out who you are in there. I don't have that much time.
Okay, that's good. I'm feeling better on that.
So actually, none of the researchers, myself included, have access to identifying information.
Hmm.
So everyone's just a case number.
Okay.
And that that just makes confidentiality a whole lot easier.
That's all I am to you, is just a case number. I feel so small now. But I feel...
There is the question of, are you doing anything that's celebrating a significant 200th birthday?
Yeah, that question needs to come up.
I think that set off a trigger.
Yeah, that would set off a trigger. There are some places where you can type in open-ended answers, and I don't know if you go through there, but I've typed in some things that might get your researchers to chuckle a little bit. So we'll see if you can
okay,
go
now
and
I'm find. Go find
yeah,
it.
Exactly. Anyways, but talking about this, let's talk results, because if there's one thing Brad Wright gets, it's results. You can just look at the UConn basketball program there; it's all results oriented. Another championship after another championship. This is still in its early phases. You've really been only at it for about 6 months. You got 1,700 folks going on here. Nothing is published yet. And oh, by the way, on the website, if you go there, there's a spot for research that comes out of this. So I'm expecting in, you know, maybe the next several months or a year or two that there's going to be stuff that appears there. You can read all about this kind of stuff. But I'm sure that you're looking at the data. This is like a big, huge Christmas present wrapped up there underneath the tree, and you go, oh, stuff is coming in. I got to go take a look at some of this stuff. Have you started to look at some of the top line data, stuff that's coming in, and what interesting things have you found out?
We have, and as you anticipated, it'd be impossible not to. And the variable that we've looked at the most is spiritual awareness. So basically, how aware are you of God at this moment, or if you don't believe in a God, a higher power, or whatever's divine or of significance to you. And, in fact, on the website, we posted a report last week where we summarized some results. And we kind of have it hidden more than we should, so we're going to have to figure out how to bring it more to the foreground. And a couple of things surprised us, both by what we found and what we didn't find. One is, there's just a lot of variation in that question. It goes all the way from 0 to 100.
Hmm.
And maybe 11-12% of the daily surveys had somebody saying, yeah, I am completely and fully, or I'm very high in my awareness of God right now. And maybe 5 or 6% said, no, not at all. Within people, there's a lot of variation. So if some, in the report, I pull up three women who are Methodists, or not who are Methodists, who are a mainline Protestant in their 50s. And I compare their spiritual awareness scores. And one is very consistently low, but the other two span the spectrum. You know, so they range from 40 to 80. And so that suggests that there's something to study, that there are times where sometimes people feel that they are aware, and sometimes they feel that they're not aware. In terms of what it varies by, a couple of cute findings. One, to my great surprise, hours of sleep did not matter. But quality of sleep mattered greatly. So we have one question in there that says, how many hours did you sleep? That didn't matter to spiritual awareness. But how well did you sleep last night? That's a huge predictor. Another real big predictor is gratitude. If you feel grateful, you're more aware of big, important things in your life than if you don't feel grateful. There's a little bit of a time effect in that the time of day mattered. In general, people were more spiritually aware in the morning, and then it decreased steadily throughout the day. It wasn't a big effect, but it was there. And I think in the future, as we look at work and different activities as they vary by day, I think we'll clarify that finding. In terms of activities, we found that people felt the most spiritually aware when they were praying or at a religious service, which you'd expect, but you know, it's the kind of thing where I've been surprised by the data often enough that I still test. And then listening to music and preparing food. So those are all things where people have higher levels of spiritual awareness. Working and being on a computer tended to result in lower spiritual awareness. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And suggests that for people who are interested in spirituality, that how we experience it at work is a big issue.
I can see how that plays out, because again, in the morning I get up and I say my prayer saying, hey, thanks for getting me up another day, Lord, and bless me throughout the day. And so I'm more aware of God. But then, as you write another memo and all these other things, pile up throughout the day, you become less aware. Interestingly enough, when we say grace at dinner time, I'm like, okay, that's when I feel aware too. And I get these surveys sometimes, about an hour after dinner and stuff. So I feel aware. Let me ask you about the sleep quality, because that is one I'm really interested in. You say there's a relationship there, but what is the relationship? Because I could see it go either way, that if you get a good night's sleep, you feel really close to God. But on the other hand, if you don't get a good night's sleep, I walk through the days kind of fuzzy and almost like I'm on mescaline or something like that. I might feel this kind of spiritual experience because I'm in this fuzzy zone. What is the direction there?
Well, now, just the fact that you asked that question and could come up with two viable alternatives shows why it's so cool to collect data.
Yeah.
You can answer the question. I mean, we could just sit over in the pub over two beers and try to figure it out and not come to a definitive answer. Mm-hmm. But the answer is the first. More sleep is more God.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. You could also think of less sleep equals more need for God, and so you reach out to God more.
Yeah.
You know? Better the sleep, the more people are aware of God. So that suggests that there's an emotional energy component to it, that it takes some effort. And people have that when they slept well.
Oh, that's really fascinating. And any relationship with amount of drink in the past? Because that is one of the questions. It doesn't appear all the time, but it appears on occasion that says, how many drinks have you had in the past past 24 hours, I think it is. And I always have my bar night is always Thursday night, and my wife lets me go out and hang around with my barfly friends. And I'm curious on how that one comes out, because I actually have experiences where I feel closer to people after that experience than I normally do. I don't know if it's the beer talking or it's just being with, other people who are sharing their everyday successes and failures or something. I don't know.
Yeah, it's just the beer praying.
Yeah, exactly.
I have not looked at it with the full data set that we've collected so far.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at it with the beta data. So this is last summer I looked at it, and I didn't find a consistent relationship. Now, take that with a grain of salt, and I'll need to look at it, and I'm sure something that we'll be putting in a report soon. Although, with the report that you get at the end of 14 days, that's one of the things, I believe, of what's your spiritual awareness, and how does it vary by how much you drank.
Mm.
So, for you, Tony, you'll get that data. I haven't looked at the sample yet.
Yeah, it'll be interesting, because I can't remember what I answered after that. And like I said, there was one time that this did pop up when I was at the bar, and I tried to fill it out at that time, but the thing timed out. So that might have been a interesting result to see how that all played out. Let me kind of close here by, noting that you don't have everything in yet, and you're just at the front end of this project, and you're going to be analyzing stuff. What is the future of this project? Do you intend to do this for just a few more months, several years? Do you think there might be opportunities to expand this in other areas? What is the future of Soul Pulse?
Well, that's a great question. It's something I thought about some. We're certainly signed up for 3 years with the Templeton Grant, and our goal is to get 10,000 respondents in the next 3 years, next 2.5 years, since we're already 6 months into it. Mm-hmm. So we're definitely on board for through 2016. But an interesting thing about this type of research is that the marginal cost of each additional respondent, the additional cost, is pretty low.
Yeah, almost zero. Yeah.
And so there's no reason we can't just keep it up and continue to collect data. The extreme version of that could almost be an online version of the general social survey. It goes on and on and on, and we can just swap in and out different questions, different modules. So that's very possible. So it'll be interesting to see what happens, but certainly it's going to run for the next 2.5 years.
Has anybody else come to you and said, wow, this is a really cool idea, we want to learn from you and do this with other types of surveys? I mean, you just mentioned the general social survey, which is a pretty long survey, but one could imagine mini versions of the GSS all of a sudden appearing on everybody's phones every day. Has anybody approached you on that?
Not yet, although the first paper we're writing is on the methodology of online ESM studies. And because we found that when we did this, there was just nothing out there. It took us a lot of time to figure out things that, frankly, I would have preferred to read ahead of time. and to avoid having to make the mistakes. And so we're trying to help people out with that by writing a paper on this.
Well, we are going to be looking forward to that paper. We have
it's going to be a barn burner.
It is. The methodology of stuff is really cool, stuff that I really like, and it's really neat talking to somebody who is a pioneer in this technology and that I've been doing it, and I feel part of the survey. I'm not going to get credit for being a researcher, but I know I'm one of those dots in your data set there, and that is really cool. We will point our listeners back to Soul Pulse, and you can check out our website to get the link to go there, and we encourage you to help out Brad with his study. And Brad, want to thank you for once again being on Research on Religion.
Well, and thank you, and it's a real treat and an honor to be on your bicentennial episode.
Art.
And congratulations, Tony. You're doing great work, and you're really moving the ball forward in terms of understanding research on religion.
Yay!
Well, thank you very much, and we hope to talk to you soon.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.